Blog Talk Radio.
Tornado.
All right, folks, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Hello, boys and girls. It's the boys of Toledo, Tony Pennycal.
Tom?
I'm here.
We got Psychic Tom on the line as well. And tonight we have a special guest in the second hour, a guy by the name of Chris Clements. He's been having his second fight in the UFC this weekend. And got plenty of back news to cover. Plus, over the weekend, we had some big boxing events. Big mixed martial arts fights. If you have Showtime anyway, you saw it. But big upset over the weekend. You know, your boy from Philly there, Danny Garcia, pulled off the upset on Amir Khan there, Tony.
Yeah. I don't think Danny should have been a 6-1 or 7-1 underdog. And it's funny, I was just talking to my dad. Our one neighbor was flying back from Las Vegas this past weekend, and she was sitting next to Danny on the plane, talking to him the whole way back to Philly.
Cool.
Yeah. Danny should not have been a 6 or 7-1 underdog. He's a very capable fighter. He's got good skills. And Amir Khan is, I'll be frank when I say it, was more skilled. He was a more skilled fighter. Unfortunately, he has a major Achilles heel, and that Achilles heel rests below his mouth, that being his chin. And, I mean, I've seen him knocked down. I've seen him knocked out. I've seen him hurt. And I'm talking to my dad about the fight, you know, after Danny's father, Angel, was, you know, getting all up in arms and getting all fired up. And I was like, yeah, I said, I think they did that to get into Khan's head and to make him want to stand and trade. Because if it came down to a pure boxing match, I don't think Garcia had the speed to compete with him. And Garcia is a good, fast fighter. And I'm like, I think they wanted to get Khan so out of his game that he wanted to stand and trade. And then my dad was like, well, for the first few rounds, he was giving it to Garcia. I'm like, yeah, he was. But the problem is he was standing right in front of him, and there was no way he could win that fight once Garcia started hitting him back. He doesn't have the chin to stand up to him. And that's what happened.
Yeah, I didn't get to see the fight, but I definitely read a lot about it.
Khan clearly won the first two rounds. And he was getting Garcia with some fast combinations. What I did notice in the first round, though, was that Garcia landed a pretty nice little right uppercut. And Khan, you know, he dipped a little bit. It was subtle. But I remember, I said, that punch got his attention. And but Khan was still winning the fight. The first knockdown was a punch that landed below his ear. It was a counter left hook, and Khan went down hard. And I think the referee could have stopped it right there, to be honest. I mean, he got up, and he kind of reminded me a little bit of Trevor Burbick in the Tyson fight. He didn't go down the other two times before, but he got up, and he was, like, swaying all around. I'm like, damn. And if there was any more time, really, in that round, it might have been over right there. It comes out to the fourth round, and, you know, Garcia came after him immediately and put him right down. And then, he was hitting him some more shots, and then he finally caught him with a left hook on top of the head, and as Khan was going down, he caught him with the right uppercut. And Khan went down in the seat of his pants, and he got up, maybe on the count of four or five, you know, and Kenny Bayless finished the count, and they had a point of view camera, like from, I guess, Bayless' shirt. You could look directly at Khan. And he was saying, I'm okay. But his eyes looked like saucers. They looked about three times the normal size. And I'm like, I thought they could have let the fight continue, but I could see why Bayless did not. I mean, Tom was responding, but at the same time, I mean, his eyes, the lights were on, but nobody was home.
Yeah. I read somewhere somebody said that they watched, you know, obviously as a boxing writer, watched the fight, and they said that his real weakness, Khan, was that he's normally more of a strategic fighter, and he kind of gave in to the brawling aspect of the fight, and instead of clinching in the right opportunities, he just decided to trade, and that's not his strength. It really blew it for him. But, you know, now, of course, the Amir Khan picture is pretty bleak. I mean, obviously he's going to keep fighting, but, you know, the whole deal with him just getting the title is kind of blown over now. He's not going to get the big fights anymore until he really proves himself again and makes a big recovery. But even actually Roger Mayweather today, I read, was giving him advice to not think about it, move on.
Well, what was even more interesting is they were talking about this fight, if he beat Danny Garcia, as being a springboard to a fight with Floyd Mayweather. And that would have been a complete mismatch. First of all, Tom would have had to move up 7 pounds. Mayweather was too fast, his reflexes too good, and Khan's chin too weak and too easy to hit. I would have seen that being a 2 to 3 round Mayweather whitewashing. Now, the fight there now has been discussed, obviously, is in the last 3 or 4 days. So I was, well, what about Danny Garcia and Floyd Mayweather? I don't think Garcia is ready for that step yet, but somebody brought up a great point. Who cares about the actual in-ring fight? The press conferences between Danny's father, Angel, and Floyd's uncle, Roger, and father, Floyd Sr., would be off the charts.
Yeah.
That would be insane.
I did see the little clip that Ice-Man John Scully sent out 2 days before the fight, a press conference clip.
Yeah,
pretty outrageous. Kind of funny. Another fight, I actually watched one fight this weekend, and it wasn't even MMA, believe it or not. It was Friday Night Fights, and I watched because I'm a big fan of Glenn Johnson. And, you know, being one of the older guys in the sport that's been successful in recent years. He was in the Super 6 tournament as an alternate and did fairly well for himself. And unfortunately, we might have seen him fight his last fight unless something else comes along. He didn't have a really bad performance, but I was kind of screaming at him, you know, in my own house watching the fight, going, throw the right hook.
Yeah.
And he actually did start to land it late in the fight, the looping right hook, and he was catching Fonfara with it every time. Andrew Fonfara is the guy he fought, and the fight went the distance, but Glenn Johnson lost on points. I'm not sure what the exact margin was, but he lost quite a few rounds there, and he has such a tight defensive style, and it really wasn't like he took a lot of damage, but he just wasn't able to score much on his own. And I just kept seeing Fonfara coming in with his left hand a little bit down, and damn, like right in like the last few rounds, Johnson kept coming over the top and just nailing him with that right hook, but just wasn't enough. Too little, too late, I guess. And,
yeah, well, wouldn't you say that was kind of a case of the old lion against the young buck, you know?
Yeah.
And then in the semi-main, in the fight before, how about Castillo? How about that one?
I saw a brief spot to that one. I didn't see the whole thing, but that was a good fight.
There was the cliche that the old guy still had a good couple rounds left in him. So sometimes that's, you just never know when you put the young... the young upcomer against the older experienced guy. It's just fascinating to watch, and I thought it was a great card.
Yeah, that was the one where he didn't come out for a round. And they called it, right?
Well, the referee stopped it apparently. I didn't have any objection. I don't know how you guys felt. I had no objection to the stoppage. It just seemed like what was his name, Popoko, or he was hanging in there, and you know, I liked his strategy of shifting to southpaw. A lot of times that doesn't work for guys, but he seemed to be able to pull it off and survive. But he didn't have the offense to stop Castillo, and then we seen what happened.
Yeah, that was a good Friday Night Fight lineup there for names and for action across the board. They did a good job putting that stuff together. But, the other fights we had over the weekend, MMA fights, Strike Force had their big latest fight with the main event being Tim Kennedy and Luke Rockhold. And Luke Rockhold won on points. I didn't see it at all. As I said, the only fights I watch is Friday Night Fights. But I did see an article. I didn't even read the article, but I saw an article the next day saying Strike Force should be immediately dissolved. And I just kind of had to laugh myself because knowing the inside of it, you know, the backstory. Obviously, you know, because the UFC had such a reputation of just acquiring companies and then destroying them or folding them completely into the UFC. When they acquired Strikeforce, there was some kind of language in the contract. And it's a private matter. They didn't really even want to release or let out the asking price. And I think it was like $40 million was the price that came out. But I think Scott Coker wrote it in there somewhere to make the deal happen that they couldn't destroy it and that they had to come out and say business as usual. And one of the things that's really making it impossible for the UFC to even inadvertently kind of destroy it by not marketing it and taking people away from it into the UFC is the Showtime deal. And as long as they have a deal with Showtime, there is no way they're going to fold that in. And when I asked Scott Coker myself on the last conference call that I got word on about whether the heavyweight division folding was an indication that the whole league would fold, he made a real big deal about the Showtime contract. And he said, as long as we're on Showtime, we're in business. So everybody thinking that that's just a matter of time. Yeah. Count your chickens before they're hatched, and don't think that's imminent, because it's not. But interestingly enough, after that Rockhold win, apparently Anderson Silva came out through his management team and said that's who he wants to fight next, Luke Rockhold, even though he knows that's not possible. Because Rockhold still has a contract with the UFC, with Strikeforce. But also on that card, we had a Tyrone Woodley getting knocked out by Nate Marquardt. And Marquardt's appeared on Inside MMA last week. And not Inside MMA, but MMA Uncensored on Spike. And said that he wants to get back into the UFC and talked to Dana White personally about it, and it's a possibility. So I don't think he has an official, you know, binding contract for Strikeforce, but if he has another win or two like that, I think it's almost a lock that he'll be back in the UFC. But it was a good card overall. And last week we had another Strikeforce veteran there on the show, Misha Tate, and there's going to be a big August card with her on it, and Ronda Rousey is facing Sarah Kaufman, who's a big-time slugger, so I think we're going to see her striking is going to have to improve if she's going to be able to beat Kaufman, too. But Actually, it's kind of funny. When we were on the show with Misha last week, she mentioned Ronda Rousey and her ESPN The Body magazine being hypocritical. And lo and behold, Bleacher Report had an article that I saw today about her calling out Ronda Rousey. And it was on Twitter. They didn't have reference our interview, but I guess she went out on Twitter after the fact a couple nights ago and made it official, saying that it was hypocritical of her to claim the ring girls were in poor taste for posing in Playboy when she did an artistically nude thing in ESPN. And the whole article was like, you know, does she understand what nude means? Because artistically nude would be, you know, you can actually see everything, but it's done in an artistic fashion. The ESPN body is not that way. They don't show everything, so it's not officially nude. It's like just another thing that reminds me of how Bleacher Report makes stories out of nothing.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. And, of course, we got UFC 149 this weekend. It's Saturday, Faber versus Barao. Uriah Faber is 26-5. Barao, reigning Pagato Barao is 28-1. And it's going to be an interesting fight. I don't think Uriah has faced anybody of this caliber, even though his Barao doesn't have that much UFC experience. He's coming in with quite the record here, so... We'll see what happens there. Another guy in the running to face Anderson Silva is Hector Lombard. He's fighting Tim Boach in the co-main event. Lombard's 31-2-1. Boach is 15-4. And Lombard is pretty much new to the UFC here. He was in Bellator and one of those folks that got taken away from that circuit. And we'll see how he does here in the big show. Another guy, Czech Congo, he's on the card. He's 17-7-2, fighting Sean Jordan, who's 13-3. Congo, I like to say, he's probably the most physically gifted fighter who never looks the way, looks as good fighting as he does physically to me. I mean, I've never seen him have a real solid fight.
Very accurate description. Very accurate.
It's just unpredictable. I mean, you never know what's going to happen. And he just, I mean, he looks like he could tear somebody's head off when you get a first glance at him. But then he gets in the cage and he just seems to struggle every time. And I think even when he wins, it's like a fluke almost.
Are you telling me that your money's on Jordan?
I don't know enough about Jordan to tell one way or another, but if I was betting, I probably would bet on Jordan just because.
I feel the same way, and as far as the main event, Faber. If you would have asked me this maybe 5 years ago, back in Faber's WEC days, he just seemed to have that it factor. He was just a step ahead of everyone. And I don't know what's happened. I don't think he's fallen drastically, but he's just not what he was then. And my money's on Barao. I mean, if I'm wrong, we'll see. It should be very competitive. But I am so impressed with how Barao can transition. I mean, his stand-up game is sharp. He has great boxing skills. He's got good head movement, good defense. Great Muay Thai, and when it goes to the ground, he can transition so fast, and I don't know if Uriah is going to be able to counter that. My money says he won't.
Yeah, look, you know, I'm also thinking the same thing. You know, for Faber, is just, he's like one of those guys, he's more name than fight right now, and, you know, he had a bunch of good fights in the WEC, but, kind of been up and down since he joined the UFC, and yeah, obviously he got a big boost from the show, The Ultimate Fighter, and he looked really surprised when they announced too he was going to fight, and I don't think he was ready for the announcement or, you know, the matchup. period.
He better be. Well, he better be.
He might be proving us wrong. We never know.
Oh, oh.
He works hard. We know that.
And as far as...
Another guy who's fighting on this card, seems like he just fought, Brian Ebersole. He's 50-14-1. What's that for a record? 50 wins, ooh, 14 losses, 1 draw. Fighting James Head, who's 8-2. And I don't think I've ever even heard of this guy. He doesn't even have a picture on Sherdog. He's in the UFC. But I swear, Ebersole just fought. I'll have to look that up in a minute. But and we have Chris Clements, who's going to be on the show in about an hour now. He's 11-4. He's fighting Matt Riddle, who's 6-3. I think he's a veteran of the Ultimate Fighter show, if I remember correctly. I know Court McGee and Nick Ring are two Ultimate Fighter veterans. McGee is 14-2, and Ring is 12-1. And Ring, I know, has had some knee problems. He was out for a while, but now he's back, and see what happens with him and Court McGee. And we have Roland DeLorme, who's 8-1, fighting Francisco Rivera, who's 8-2. It's a pretty good even match there. Ryan Jimmo, 16-1, fighting Anthony Perosh, who's 13-6. And Misha's boyfriend from last week, we found that out, Brian Caraway, who's 16-5, fighting Mitch Gagnon, who's 8-1. And two more here. Antonio Carvalho, who's 13-5, fighting Daniel Pineda, 17-8. And finally, Mitch Clark, who's 9-1, fighting Anton Kuibinen, who's 16-5. And I never heard of him. But let's just check here on Ebersole. I swear he just fought like maybe two cards ago or something. But apparently he must have not had a tough fight. They threw him right back in there.
Well, I believe it went the distance. If you can
his last fight?
That. Yeah.
I'm dealing with a slow computer here, but it's coming up. I spent almost the last 3 or 4 days trying to fix my computer and get all the viruses off of it so we wouldn't have technical difficulties tonight. And I finally straightened everything out, and I come to find out my right click button no longer works on the mouse. So I got to find out how to fix that now. But all the viruses are gone. That's the good news. But, it was UFC on FX4, Maynard versus Guida. Unanimous decision win over TJ Waldberger.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mighty quick. That's June 22nd he just fought. That's not even... He's back in the cage. That's very surprising.
Of course, I guess if you have as many fights as he has, it's another day in the office.
Right. let's check this out. Here's another unique story I just came across today, getting back to boxing here a little bit. Talk about keep your day job. We had a story here about a boxer from Toledo. He was arrested this week and ordered held without bond on Wednesday. And he basically got caught because he got a bloody nose in a boxing match. He was a suspect in a bank robbery. And the FBI showed up at his last fight in April, and they just picked the trash for the cotton swab they used to swab his nose for the fight. I watch a lot of the cop shows, Law and Order and all that stuff, and usually they get DNA from somebody who smokes or something, or they'll give a guy a can of soda and they'll get the fingerprints off that or something. A blood swab from a boxing match being used. That's a new one.
But, yeah, that has to be a first.
So that was kind of in the weird news of the week category. And it's funny, the story mentions that they wouldn't comment on how they acquired the swab. So I think they picked it out of the trash. We got a bunch of other stories too here. If I can get my computer to work. Come on. Oh, there's a story worth talking about. Of course, we just had another UFC event. We didn't talk all that much about last week, but the main event was Tito Ortiz versus Forrest Griffin. And lo and behold, we find out this week Forrest Griffin was using a testosterone replacement therapy. And at the same time, last week, Dana White came out and said it should be illegal. Not illegal, like, as far as, you know, not allowed to be used in MMA, but illegal as in against the law. So that was kind of weird because, you know, so many guys that we found out are able to use it through the exemptions. And obviously they monitor it, especially when these guys have exemptions. And I think there's still a specific limit. There's still a specific limit of how high your testosterone can be, even if you're allowed to use TRT. But that only really is an effect for it. So nothing stops you from using it in training and being way above those limits because they don't have random drug testing. So they're not going to catch it. And some people say that it's not fair because it basically just allows guys to use steroids their whole career, you know, real nasty steroids. And when those don't work anymore, they go to testosterone. Basically, one of the symptoms of using too many steroids is your testosterone goes down. So I don't know if that's, you know, that big a deal as far as you know, why guys are using this or whether it's just, you know, other factors. Like, actually, the weight cutting is a big factor in your testosterone going down. And, you know, MMA has such wide-ranging weight classes that that's probably actually worse than the wrestling in high school and college. And I know from experience, you know, I really had to cut weight 1 year of wrestling varsity. It sucks. I've seen a lot of guys go through hell trying to cut weight. I was lucky because my senior year, I weighed about 155 and I was wrestling 171, so I never had to cut weight. I had to gain weight. That wasn't always fun either, but it is what it is. And, I mean, I really, I still haven't been convinced that testosterone replacement therapy is all that bad. I think it's kind of something that's almost a necessity for some of these older fighters who've had long careers and have been beat up a lot. And, you know, they're trying to compete with a younger class of people. And, you know, for Dana White to come out and say it should be illegal, I mean, has he looked around his own league and realized how many guys depend on this stuff to stay competitive? You know, fight more entertaining fights like he's always saying that they should. You know, some of the things that Dana White says, I like to remind people that he's never been a real fighter. He was a boxer-sized coach and never really even had an amateur career as far as I can tell from what I've read. He never even really had that much experience himself boxing. And he wouldn't even fight Tito Ortiz in a boxing match. As we know from the show that he put together that made us all think he was going to fight him.
Yeah, I wonder if that was slated for a celebrity boxing with Ortiz and Data.
Yeah, he hasn't even done celebrity boxing. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
They suck. But we got some wrestling news here. Even this week, I pulled out all the stops. The Ultimate Warrior is in trouble now. Been named in a police report, accused of bilking a collector out of $28,000 and a ton of wrestling merchandise, including ring-worn wrestling trunks. And it's a sports memorabilia dealer named Christopher Elias struck a deal with the Warrior in which he agreed to send Elias a bunch of classic merchandise from his personal collection. And Warrior was also supposed to sign 20 wrestling belts and 10 WrestleMania posters, and never did any of it. I mean, obviously, it sounds like easy money, you know, $28,000. That's a lot of money to do nothing for.
How long would it take you to sign your name 28 times?
Yeah.
You could probably knock that out in about all of 30 seconds. you look at it that way. I mean, what would your hourly rate be if you were making $28,000 in 30 seconds? That's, $56,000 a minute times 60. That's a hell of an hourly rate.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, that's going to be my new career. Whenever I go for job interviews now, I'm going to demand that rate. if the Warrior can command it, then why can't I?
Right. Well, speaking of banned substances, you were just talking about, it's also starting to be a problem in boxing. And one of the latest guys to be banned for anti-doping was Enzo Macaronelli. He's banned for 6 months. And it's actually an over-the-counter thing, it looks like. I don't even understand why this stuff is banned, but apparently it's usually listed as geranium derivative. So it's sounds like it's a natural thing, but it's called methyl hexaniamine. And it's a product which is claimed to promote mental and physical performance and aid weight loss. And it's found in a bunch of nutritional supplements. But it's actually being touted as a reminder of the stringent stance against doping in the Olympics, in the Olympic Games.
My friend a couple years ago, Rogers Matagua out of Philadelphia, and he got in trouble because he used a product that had ephedra in it. Ephedra, back about, I guess, 13 or so years ago, you know, it had come out, and I think the first product that was really widely known was a product called Metabolife. And I took it for a while when I got out of college. I had seen some weight loss results out of it. And then it came out, Metabolife has ephedra in it. You know, ephedra was causing strokes in people, causing heart attacks, high blood pressure, and all that shit. So it became a banned product. And then they were trying to come out with, like, Metabolife no ephedra, which is basically just a glorified caffeine pill. But then there was another product called Metabolite, which still used ephedra. And that's what Rogers had taken. And I don't know if he said his wife had given it to him, but he tested positive for ephedra, which they said was a banned substance because it was illegally helping him to lose weight just helping him get into a lower weight class. It's weird because, I mean, does that really help enhance your performance? I have to say yes and no. Now, I understand why they don't want a soldier being used because it is health concern.
Unless it's really a stimulant and you have really high levels right after the fight that shows you benefit from it during the fight, then I don't think they should have a problem with stuff like that. But
I mean, if you go to GNC right now, there are a lot of products you can buy that still have traces of stuff in them that any major league baseball player or professional boxer, I'm not sure how the strictness of the NFL, which I'm sure they're involved in it too. Probably half the stuff you buy at a place like GNC, you can get nailed for. And that's all over the counter stuff.
Yeah, I believe it. It just doesn't make sense, some of this stuff, though. I mean, if they're going to let these guys use testosterone and then give them an exemption for that, 6 months, it should tell you. Usually guys get tested for a year, and on their first offense for something like this, then they might get 6 months. So it's this is obviously something that's not that bad, but we'll see. I don't know. It just doesn't seem like that big a deal to me.
But I just get the feeling that there's no turning back at this point. I mean, they went so overboard on this that, I mean, some of these supplements, like I agree with you guys, it's ridiculous. I mean, you might not even know.
Yeah. The labels aren't always accurate either on some of these things. But here's another story. We have changes in the scoring of MMA. The Commission on Boxing Associations or something. I'm not sure if that's the exact label of what they are, but here it is. The Association of Boxing Commissioners decided on some changes in judging for MMA. And this is a little bit of a breakdown here on what those changes are. Effective defense is no longer a criteria for scoring. So defending takedowns or blocking submissions and strikes will not count for anything under the new rules. So the only advantage that defense is going to give a fighter now is that it keeps you from being finished off by offense. So here's another one. Striking and ring have been given equal weight. In the past, striking was always listed first as a scoring opportunity, giving it more importance, and that's not the case anymore. Striking and grappling are, from this point forward, to be viewed as equal offensive measures. Heavier strikes will be given more weight than the number of strikes landed, and they're now classifying damage as effective damage, which means strikes that do more damage will be weighed more heavily than overall strike count. And of course, like I talked about before with the boxing, they don't get the punch stat numbers, so it's still going to be a visual thing because they don't have access to those kind of statistics in either boxing or MMA. But I don't really agree with that, as I've said. Here's another change. Grappling moves that are scored heavily, takedowns, reversals, submissions, transitions, activity, and threatening moves from the fighter on the bottom, and attempted submissions that lead to the threatened fighter being tired. In theory, this will put more weight on guys who play a great guard game and constantly threaten submissions off the back. And witness the Miguel Torres versus Demetrius Johnson fight is an example. Torres consistently threatened his submissions and used plenty of sweeps and reversals from the bottom, but Johnson got the fight because he was on top. And that could be a real significant change. Also, effective aggression is now defined. Aggression in the cage is a fighter moving forward and using legal techniques. Attacking with submissions or strikes on the ground is also included. Octagon control is defined in the new rules. It means that a fighter is dictating the pace and the position of the fight in the cage. And one unfortunate note on this change is the current 10-9 system is still in place. Judges are discouraged from using 10-8 or even 10-7 round scoring, even when it's more than warranted. Dana White came out and criticized the Wanderlei Silva versus Rich Franklin fight because he said that the judges should have given Silva a 10-8 round. Round two, I think, when Franklin got rocked. And they didn't. None of them did. So my fight would have been a tie, I think, on most of the cards if they had done that.
But why do we have to even talk about that? I mean, shouldn't that be common sense?
Yeah.
You know, and as far as we're going for damaging strikes against the number of strikes, well, shouldn't that be common sense?
Yeah.
What am I missing? And then as far as not giving credit for defense, I mean, I think we can look at the boxing world, and both you guys, I hope, will agree with me that a lot of guys will come into a boxing gym and everyone wants to learn how to punch. punch, 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 punch. Well, of course you have to know that. But the real skill in the sweet science is defense. And I think it's the same thing in jiu-jitsu. I mean, to take that out of the scoring equation, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm seeing it different. I'll listen to you guys.
Well, I mean, I definitely agree that it's important, but I think it's kind of wrapped into ring generalship or octagon control, as they call it. So it's kind of rolled into a different factor. And I don't think anybody ever really, you know, had a problem in scoring a fight because they scored too much defense.
that's true. That's true. But...
And it's just an overall picture of the fight. It's important, obviously. But, when you consider defensive scoring, the only time I would consider, to be a factor is when you're talking about counterpunching.
Right.
You know,
right.
Counter-striking or countering a submission or defending a takedown, that sort of thing. And then it becomes, something that the fight hinges on. You know, if you defend every takedown against a wrestler and keep it on the feet and beat the guy senseless because of that, and the guy's strength is on the ground, then obviously defense played a huge role in the fight, but it doesn't necessarily translate into the scorecards. Either way, I mean, the big thing is the 10-8 round shouldn't be discouraged by any means. I mean,
I mean, to me, it's just so screamingly obvious in some of these rounds. And I mean, as always, there is an element of subjectivity in some of them. But if someone's rocked and just hanging on and you're going to go 10-9, excuse me, why are you there?
Right. And they're both overseen. Both the MMA and boxing are overseen by boxing commissions. So...
Mm-hmm.
These boxing commissioners have made this change, so you would think that they would want to at least one consistent rule in both sports as far as scoring goes. But.
And you know what? It was, you guys were just elaborating on it, the 10-point muscle for the MMA. With mixed martial arts, you know, your undercard fights are 3 rounds, and your title fights are 5. So, and these are 5-minute rounds, whereas opposed to boxing is a series of 3-minute rounds. So you have a title fight in a box. Now, a lot of your undercard boxing matches are 4 or 6 rounds, moving up to 8, 10, and then eventually 12. So, yeah, in the preliminary fight, once you lose a round or two, you know, you're in deep shit. You know, it's hard to come back from that. But you take it like this. You have a mixed martial arts fight. Now, I said, I'm not as versed in the sport as you guys are. I remember watching one a couple of years ago just because Kimbo was on the card and he was first breaking into mixed martial arts at the time. I remember watching one fight, and it wasn't a very good fight. And one guy was trying to fight on his back the whole time and was just kind of kicking at the guy when the guy was coming after him. And these were 5-minute rounds. There wasn't a lot of action. And it was 3 rounds. And I'm like, well, I think Fighter A won all 3 of those rounds easily. And they're like, well, I don't know, it's pretty close. And I'm like, pretty close. And next thing you know, he ended up winning a split decision. 2 judges gave him 2-1. He was 29-28. The other judge had it for the other fighter, 29-28. And I don't think that type of scoring is right for smaller, longer rounds. I think it's got to be more of a where you can accumulate points during the course of a round. That way, this round, maybe you, not 10-9, maybe something more along the lines of like, 20-16 or something, where you get so much you dominated that round. And if the other guy wins a real close round, then maybe he would get it, like, say, 10-8, and therefore help, clear scoring. And that's just me. And I know very little about the sport, so I mean, I'm just throwing some of my idiotic ideas out there.
That's not idiotic. It's it makes sense. I mean, yeah, that's not a, that's the big difference. The duration of the rounds and the amount of rounds between the two sports. But I don't know. Either way, I think it could have taken a better look at that, and they could have done a lot better with. They shouldn't definitely not discourage people from scoring it the way they think it is. You know, if it's a 10-8 round, they think that's the way it went, then, you know, you shouldn't say, no, it's not how you should score it, because we don't score things that way. This doesn't make any sense to me. But. Here's another story. Mixed martial arts is still not legal in New York, but that hasn't stopped MMA companies from donating over $105,000 to Governor Mario Cuomo during his first 18 months in office. Muzaffa LLC and its subsidiary, Ultimate Fighting Championships, dished out about $55,000 and $50,000, respectively, to Cuomo, along with a total of $89,000 to the state Senate and Assembly. This is according to a New York Public Interest Research Group. And Cuomo's war chest is loaded now. He's got $19.3 million on hand after raising close to $6 million in the past 6 months. And 102 donors ponied up at least $40,000 each for him over the past year and a half. Let's see what else. Who else gave him money from MMA here? Doesn't say.
What is the governor's position on legalizing MMA in New York, or has he stated that?
Well, he actually said that he would approve it if it came to him, which is not really a surprise, because I think that's why they're giving him money. They know that he's pro MMA, and you know, of course, the big argument that people use as to why it should be legalized there is the money. New York is really, as a state, suffering from some deficits and some real shortcomings there with the cash coming in, revenue. So you would think they'd want the tax dollars from the events and obviously the businesses that benefit from it. But, you know, they've got this one state senator there who's just adamantly against it and seems very uneducated about it.
Now, I heard he's retiring. Have you heard that?
No, I haven't.
Okay. I'll have to double check, but you know, I'd heard that.
But yeah, some allies too are also against it, and I'm not sure if they're as uneducated as he is, but some of his allies have managed to make sure that it doesn't even get heard as far as, you know, voting and decisions. You know, like it'll get through one committee and then it'll get stuck somewhere else. So they definitely have an alliance there to keep it out of New York. And I don't know whether this year is going to be the year, or I think actually it's too late for this year, but next year might be the year. We don't know. Here's a boxing match that we didn't talk about. David Haye beat Derek Chisora pretty decisively over the weekend on Saturday.
I didn't get to see it live, but I did watch the final round on YouTube, I should say. And the fifth, which was the knockout round. And I'll tell you, man, Derek Chisora looked completely amateurish. He was swinging wide looping right hand, which is fine. I mean, he looked like, but after he was throwing them, it looked like he was really starting to suck air. But he would throw these wild looping right hands, which Hay would kind of pull away from. And next thing you know, Chisora is in the southpaw stance. He's letting his momentum carry him into a southpaw stance. Now he's trying to throw his right hand that looked worse than you would see in a hockey fight. Because he's off balance, and now he's just pushing him out there. And I'm like, yeah. I said, that almost looks like a jab from the wrong stance. That's what it looks like, a backhanded jab from the wrong stance. and then he finally caught up to him, boom, hit him, Tim Barr. Obviously, there was bad blood going into the fight, so he proved the point there. From what I watched of it, I mean, I'd have to go back and watch the first four rounds, so I don't know if I want to do that. But I don't know if he really impressed me all that much. I mean, what may have helped was the fact that Chisora has gone 12 rounds with Vito Ritsuko and, remained upright the whole time. And, you know, he didn't even go half that distance with David Hay. That could be a feather in Hay's cap. But other than that, I never thought Chisora was a, worthy title contender anyway.
Right. There is a lot of talk about the fact that he lost on points to Vitaly Klitschko last February. That's really the reason why Hay fought him, is because they had a little brawl at the press conference that followed that fight. But now Hay is trying to claim that Vitaly should fight him next. He's got a fight in September against Manuel Char in Moscow, September 8th, but, much like Fedor retired at home, it looks like Vitaly is going to make that his last fight. I think we talked about on a previous show that he's got signs of Parkinson's already. So he's obviously worried about his health, and he does want to get into a political career over there in Russia. So be perfect opportunity for him to put the gloves away on his home turf in September here. And he's already 40, so, you know, it's not too old by any means in this day and age, but it's old for a boxer. Anyway. But the first thing is, obviously, I don't think Chisora was as in shape for this one as he probably was for the fight with Vitaly. But, you know, you obviously also can't consider fight math when you put two guys together, because there's so many different factors as far as, you know, preparation for each particular fight, styles, you know, the works. It's always going to be different. You know, you can't just say, all right, well, this guy beat him in five rounds and the other guy got a decision, so A, you know, A plus B equals C. You know, you can't figure that out from previous fights all the time. It's always going to be different dynamics. But the other thing was Vitaly has come out and said publicly, since Hay has called him out and wants to fight him, he says, hey, you know, you gave up the opportunity to fight me to fight Chisora. So, you know, go pound sand. So I don't think that's going to happen. But I legitimately think that Vitaly probably is not interested in fighting Hay because he would have a chance to lose that fight. Not that he would lose, but he would probably struggle a little bit in that type of fight. But I know somebody who does need a fight is Vander Holyfield. So maybe if Vitaly does decide to hang up the gloves, then maybe he, David Hay and Vander Holyfield can fight for the interim belt.
Cool.
I just read too that they finally kicked Holyfield out of his mansion, so he definitely needs some money. Let's see what else we got. Female boxer from Thailand is in the news because she's recorded a highly suspicious level of testosterone before a world title fight in Melbourne. We're about to debut at the London Olympics, so this was kind of a interesting story to go along with that. She's a Thai bantamweight, Usanakorn Kokiachim, and she was detected with three times the normal level of testosterone for a woman. And so, of course, that's put out some speculation about her gender. And the 24-year-old had been ordered to undergo hormone testing before fighting the Australian Madon, whose trainer, Barry Michael, had accused Usain Acorn of punching harder than most blokes I know. Ramadan won a brutal 10-round fight at Flemington's Melbourne Pavilion. So obviously, even if the girl's testosterone, she didn't help her. After the bout, Usain Acorn denied taking any anabolic steroid drugs when interviewed by the World Boxing Council secretary and two ringside physicians. Speaking with the help of an interpreter, she refused comprehensive blood testing that would have proven her gender. And all medical findings will be forwarded to the Mexican headquarters of the WBC, which is expected to investigate the allegations. And actually, a South African runner was embroiled in a similar scandal in 2009 after winning the Women's World 800-meter crown as an 18-year-old. And within hours of that race, the International Association of Athletic Federations announced that the runner would be gender tested, which sparked public outrage from the South African government. The results were never made public, but Semenya was cleared to run by the IAAF, which introduced new eligibility rules last year for female athletes with excessive male hormones. And according to the Australian Ringside Medicine Association, there's a possibility that she started off as a man and had taken estrogen, or we could be dealing with a woman who was pumped up on steroids, or she could be a hermaphrodite. You have the genes of a male and female. So there are other explanations, I guess. And other medical conditions, including endocrine disorders, could contribute to elevated hormone levels. So you got testosterone replacement therapy, testosterone freakish. Female boxer, I guess. I don't know. Allegedly female, I guess we should call her. Anyway, that's kind of crazy. I don't know if we've ever seen that in MMA, except I do remember seeing joking references to Cyborg Santos there, who was actually also busted for steroids, being called the man. But there was no serious allegations. It was all just kind of jokes that she was a man. And here's another story about amateur boxing. The International Boxing Association is set to drop headguards for elite men in amateur boxing ahead of the Rio 2016 Olympic Games, although they will remain in place for both female and junior fighters. And this is kind of something that's very underreported. I just kind of caught this on an offhand glance and never saw anything else about it since then. I'm actually probably going to write my own article about this. But I'm kind of curious to know what you guys think. Do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea? No head guards for the top-tier amateurs.
The big thing about headgear is the biggest advantage they give to you is it limits the potential of cuts, especially around the eyes. Because if you put a headgear on and the forehead padding generally comes up right above your eyebrows. So, yeah, so right there, it's hard to get a clean blow on the eyebrow, which, would obviously, force the cut when it scrapes against the bone. Then with your cheek guards, that's the biggest advantage. But when it comes to people saying, oh, my God, headgears prevent concussions and they prevent brain injuries, no, that's not the case. You just figure, I guess, most headgears weigh about 8 to 10 ounces. So you figure, if you put 10 ounces on your head now weighs 10 ounces heavier. You take a hard shot that snaps your head back, that is basically whiplashing your neck with an extra 10 ounces on there, which is even more force slamming the brain into your skull. It doesn't protect the chin, all it does is have a strap down there. So the biggest advantage to headgear is the prevention of cuts. Now, in an amateur-style tournament, you can understand why you want to prevent cuts, because you figure in an Olympics, a guy is going to have to fight, what, 5 to 6 times? And he can win his first fight. If there's an accidental clash of heads in there, he gets cut. Well, now he's out of the tournament. Now, back in the day, I know Ali won the Olympic gold medalist. They didn't wear headgear then. Joe Frazier, George Foreman. I remember pictures of Foreman bloodying up the Russian with his jab, giving him a bloody nose and a bloody mouth, which is what, you know, forced the stoppage, and he winning the gold medal. I know in the 76 Olympics, watching guys like Sugar Ray Leonard, the Spinks brothers, Howard Davis, and some of those other great fighters that are possibly the greatest Olympic team of all time, those guys not wearing headgear. By the time you got to 84, because remember the U.S. Team boycotted the 80 Olympics, by the time you got to 84, the great like Holyfield, Pernell Whitaker, Mark Breland, Melger Taylor, those guys were now in headgear. So it's a you know, 6 in one hand, half dozen in the other. It will prevent, you know, cuts and more facial injuries, which would be beneficial when a person's got a fight, 4, 5, or maybe 6 fights. But on the other hand, it doesn't really prevent any head injuries.
Tom, what do you think about this?
I would totally agree, because I know just from my Tough Man experience, I've seen so many guys KO'd, and, you know, people would have that idea, well, there's headgear on, come on, that's going to protect you. But as Tony said, no, I mean, that's exactly the case. So I would agree.
Yeah, I think that, you know, boxing is one of those sports where it's dangerous no matter what the conditions are.
Sure.
But there's all kinds of different headgear setups, too. You know, some people like one style over another. First, like sparring and all that, and training. But once it gets into competition, especially with the way that Olympic scoring has been set up with the white points on the glove, and, you know, you have to have a scoring punch with that, and it's I think it's a lot harder to score points in that format with headgear on. And I don't know if they're going to change that too before the 2016 games, but I would think they should. Another part of this, the same International Boxing Association meeting, another change that was made was they actually decided to create a whole new level of boxing. Now you have the amateurs, the professional, the official professionals, and there's going to be the International Boxing Association Professional Boxing. So they actually have created a kind of a limbo where you can box professionally, but you still have your Olympic eligibility. So that's kind of an interesting development. Apparently, they're going to debut this at the end of next year, and it's probably going to piss off some of the official boxing promoters, because it's going to stop the best boxers from joining the official professional ranks if they want to still stay eligible for the Olympics. They've already actually secured the services of some big-name boxers, including reigning amateur super heavyweight champ Magomed Rasul Medvedev of Azerbaijan, a gold medal favorite for the London Games here. And they're just going to be debuting the women's boxing for the first time here in the London Olympic Games. So I'm sure some of those women will want to opt into this too. And we already know that the women's boxing ranks, the professionals, need some more competitors. Because, you know, every week I see in the box rec schedule there's mismatched fights because they just can't find competitive fights for these women in a lot of cases. So I think the women's boxing area will be way more affected by this kind of thing. But we'll see. The APB preseason will kick off in January 2013. So, I don't know how that's going to go, but we'll see. I think they should just do like they do with the basketball. I don't understand why, you know, one sport or another can allow professional athletes to compete when another one can't. Doesn't make much sense, but that's the way it goes.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. We can get our boxing dream team.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, give guys like Floyd Mayweather another chance to win that gold medal that he should have had in 96. Obviously, Roy Jones is well past his prime, but if they would have had a dream team, you know, maybe about 8 years ago, gave him a chance to win that gold medal that he got robbed of in 88. Put together the U.S. boxing dream team. I mean, there you go.
I'm just wondering how Jones would do today, you know, even at his advanced age. That's kind of an interesting thought.
True. He still have a very good chance of, pulling it off and winning it. I mean, he would obviously, I think his biggest competition would come from, still over in Cuba, because there's a lot of those guys, unless they defect, still playing the Cuba national team. So, he would have a significant experience advantage over anybody, even on the Cuban team. I mean, this is a guy that's been doing this for 30 years now. And, on a, amateur, he was for in a elite level 20, 20 years ago. And he's been a professional elite. He's been on a championship level now for 19 years.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how it would work if they have age cut over for the Olympics. But, it'd be interesting if they could get these guys, an opportunity to fight like that. And it's really not another sport that's as international as boxing either, And it's already kind of set up like the Olympics are, where you've got foreign fighters fighting Americans and vice versa, and foreign fighters fighting each other all the time. And it's a sport that's probably older than the Olympics itself, Then, of course, you'd have to allow pro wrestlers to wrestle in the Olympics. That wouldn't be good. we'll see. So I'm working on it. All right, folks, sorry about that. We had a little disconnect there. I was trying to add our guest, and everything just froze. So, we're right in the middle of talking about the Olympics and all those pro fighters not getting a chance like the basketball guys do. But we're working on getting on Chris the Menace Clements. I just got to try to plug in his number without crashing my system here. Mm-hmm. It really sucks that I can't use the right click button right now. Anyway. Give us a minute and we'll get that straightened out while we're While we're waiting here, we might as well mention our good sponsors, drinkcocaine.com and Milifidel, M-I-L-I-F-I-D-E-L.com. And they actually just unleashed a big spokesman this week. We've always known, but they made it official this week that Bill Goldberg, the wrestler, is on board with them, and he's going to be official from here on out. And they had a big military appreciation day at Miramar Marine Corps Air Station over the course of this afternoon up there that he took part in. So congratulations to them on bringing Bill on board. We'll try to get him on the show one of these days. And if we can get some questions written down, you guys can participate too once I get Tom on.
Okay.
See, so if you guys have any Bill Goldberg questions, we'll pose them to him. I guess he wants some written questions before he gets on the show, so he knows what we're going to spring on him. He doesn't want any surprises. You know, these pro wrestling guys, they like everything scripted.
We had our talk with CDT a few months ago. And we only talked to Frank Cameron a few months after I started co-hosting the show.
Yeah, twice we had him on.
Pro wrestling. I'm a pro wrestling fan. I always have been. I was interested in talking to Frank Cameron because, you know, he participated during WWE. With Stone Cold and Shawn Michaels was still wrestling, and Undertaker, a bunch of really good guys. And I had seen him wrestle live a couple times. And then DDP, of course, you know, yeah, he wrestled to Hulk Hogan, the Macho Man. You know, I was always a big Mick Foley fan, and, you know, I had to read one of Mick's books that day. And talking about some of their on the road stories together, so that's why I had to ask him about that. And more wrestling questions than anything.
Yeah, I was reading his biography the other day to put the press release together about his being a spokesman, and I actually never followed it that closely to know it, but he was actually a title holder for tag teams with Bret Hart. I never knew that. So
I kind of remember that. I know he was the one that unfortunately ended Bret's career. They had an accident during a match, and he took some money, did give him a concussion, which pretty much led to the downfall of Bret's pro wrestling career. Obviously, he wasn't on purpose.
And he also was one of the original commentators for the predecessor to Strikeforce, Elite XC. So he's definitely got some MMA background. When he was doing that, he was asked at one point if he was going to get into MMA, and he said, you know, if it came along earlier, he probably would have gotten into it, but he never did. So he'll definitely be a good guest across the board. I'm sure he'll want to talk a little bit about MMA, and he was actually at the event out at Miramar with a couple MMA guys, and he owns a gym out there in California. And one of his partners is a UFC guy. And for some reason, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but I know that Joey Beltran, the Mexicutioner, they call him, he's one of the guys that trained. So we're just working on connecting Chris Clements here. It'll be another minute or so here. We'll have him on. And he's fighting Matt Riddle this weekend, this Saturday at UFC 149. I think it's going to be on the main card. We'll see on pay-per-view. Let's just connect in. It's 11-4 is his record. He also last December, and is coming off a win over Keith Whitley back in April. Won by split decision there.
This is Chris. I'm unavailable, but I'm probably not far from my phone. So if you leave me a quick message, I'll get back to you as soon as possible.
Katie got the memo from Dana White. Chris, this is Rabble Rouse and Rich Bros around here. We're on the Fight News Unlimited Combat Sports Show, trying to get in touch with you for an interview. I know we're a few minutes late here, but hopefully we can get back with you. We'll try again in a few minutes, 5 or 6 minutes or so. And looking forward to it. Talk to you later. Bye. So, have to wait on that one. But I do have another couple stories here in the works. Oh, yeah. Left archive of go-to stories. And we talked a few weeks ago about an MMA fighter who died in the aftermath of a fight. Wasn't in one of those states that is fully sanctioned MMA, but definitely was a big story at the time. Anytime that a fighter dies, whether it be boxing or MMA, it's always a big story. But this one, they actually finally came out with the autopsy results, if I can find the story here. Here it is. The family of 26-year-old Dustin Jensen says he suffered a seizure after a May 18th fight at the Rushmore Plaza Civic Center. Doctors later did surgery to relieve pressure on Jensen's brain, but he was declared brain dead on May 24th and taken off life support the next day. Rapid City Police say in a release that although the timeline is consistent with the organized fight, there's no conclusive evidence the injury was sustained in the event. Mixed martial arts fighters use a variety of techniques, barring from boxing, wrestling, and various forms of martial arts. I thought there was more to this story. Here it is. The autopsy report says the fighter died of a subdural hemorrhage from blunt force trauma to the head, related to an injury from a week earlier. So that's definitely good news for MMA, bad news for the family, obviously, that the guy died. But it's definitely not one of those cases where it was the direct result of the fight. It was actually training. You know, that's actually not that great for the sport. unfortunately, you know, it's one of those things that's a dangerous sport. People do die in training and in the actual combat. So it's one of those stories that I was keeping an eye on. Another piece of boxing news. We obviously heard that Josecito Lopez is going to be fighting Canelo Alvarez in September, I think. Yeah, September. Today they announced that there's going to be another big co-main event. We have Marcos Maidana fighting Jesus Soto Carras.
How's this fight? Because both fighters tremendous chin. Both fighters are, you know, very aggressive. But the guy with Soto Carras, you know, he was, you know, destroyed by Gabriel Rosado, who was a lot faster, a lot much better boxer. You know, he was outboxed primarily in second third. The first third was good, but he got boxed by Mike Jones. Mark Madonna on the same level, you know, he had the big win over Victor Ortiz, but then he's, and he had the great players in New York time. But he's another guy that can be outboxed, you know, he's not the best in the world. But this is what you're going to get here. Two very aggressive fighters, power punching fighters, and aggressive defense. I can't see that fight being a bad one.
Yeah, definitely. You know, that whole card's going to be stacked, I'm sure, by the time they finish it up. They already got some decent guys on there. Here's another boxing story, and I don't know if you might want to cover your ears for this one, Tony. It involves your dog's namesake, Vinny Paz.
I didn't know about it. Vinny and I talked on Facebook from time to time. And actually, speaking of Mr. Paz, it was kind of funny. Last week, I bought my dad a Vinny Paz the Ender shirt back for Christmas in 1999. He still wears it all the time. So he was wearing it last week. He was doing, I forget what he was doing. So I snuck up behind him and snapped a photo of him wearing it. And I posted it on Vinny Paz's page. And he was like, oh, man, that's awesome. Tell your dad. I said, yo. And then like a little bit later, you know, I see on Facebook where he was accused of assaulting his girlfriend or something.
Well, here's the story. He pleaded not guilty to charges of assault and disorderly conduct after a bar fight in Providence involving two women. And WPROAM reports that he was released on $2,000 personal recognizance. And the Providence Journal reported that he was charged with disorderly conduct after one of the women accused him of grabbing her breast and the other said she was punched and pulled to the floor by her hair. And the five-time world champion told police he was in a minor dispute with one woman inside. Not bragging about this one by any means. He says he fell when he grabbed her wrist. No, he says she fell when he grabbed her wrist to make her let go. And Paz told WPRO he has never hit a woman. So
I know people were talking to him online last week. I really didn't say anything about that. But you're looking like this. You know, obviously, I'm not there, and you know, situation where alcohol gets involved. But I'll bring up something that I remember from way back in the day. I never hit a female. You know, when you're a little kid, you maybe smack the one girl because you think she's cute or something and shit like that. But no, I never did anything like that. Now, I'm in high school. Now, my high school, you know, we were right on the edge of Philadelphia, so we did have some, you know, city kids in there. Some of them had attitudes or whatever. So one girl, I forget what her problem was. She was flipping out about something. And I forget if she tried to hit me or whatever. Now, I was much larger than her. What I did was basically I spun her around. I almost threw her in a bear hug. I kind of grabbed both of her wrists, threw her in a bear hug, and then I kind of blocked her leg because she couldn't kick me either. So basically, right there, you could say that I beat her. I hit her. But I didn't. I was in a little bit protecting myself. Now, you're in a situation, alcohol is involved. You know, sometimes people, they have too much, they get violent. You know, it could be a situation that I don't know. I can't speak to Vinny. I didn't talk to him about this. But woman could have been drunk. She could have been, who knows, she could have been bothering him, you know, giving him a hard time. I know Vinny can get loud. He can get cocky. That's part of the reason he was my favorite fighter growing up. She should have been going off the handle, and he may have tried to grab her arm or whatever to protect himself. See, I should be a lawyer.
Yeah, right.
If I knew the law, I'd be a lawyer.
He's innocent until proven guilty.
Exactly.
And even if proven guilty, Tony will still say he's innocent.
Well, no, you know, but I'm not like that. I'm like, you get these guys out there that, you know, you know a person's obviously guilty. You know, a lot of these murder trials or whatever. Mumia Abdul-Jabbar or Jamal or whatever it is out of Philadelphia. I know, not personally, but I know family of the officer Daniel Faulkner that was killed in like 30 years ago. And my uncle knew them. He was a cop also. So this guy's obviously guilty. He's had, I can't say how many appeals and how many retrials, and every time the evidence says he's guilty. You know, I could never defend a guy like that. I'd be the defense lawyer like, yo, this motherfucker's guilty. Where's the chair?
Not too long ago, a few months ago, they just commuted that guy's death sentence, so no longer on death row. Anyway, let's give Chris another shot here. But yeah, we'll have to get the Innocence Project on this one. I don't know if he does anything, but you know, there's always groupies with guys like him. Surprised. They cooked it up.
Hello.
Hello, Chris.
Yes.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
We are live on the Fight News Unlimited Combat Sports Show. This is Rabble Rouser Rich. We also have Tony the Tornado and Psychic Tom on the line with us.
Good evening, Chris.
Oh. How you doing?
So tell us what's going through your head right now, getting ready for a big fight here with Matt Riddle, your second appearance here in the Octagon.
All I'm thinking about right now is getting my weigh-in over and having a big bowl of oatmeal and drinking chocolate milk, truthfully. I just finished doing a workout, my first weight cut workout, so it's a nice late little thing. I got to cut some more weight tonight, but you know, as far as fighting Matt Riddle, I'm real excited for it, you know. He's one of those guys that he's fun to fight. You know, he puts on fun fights, and that's the way I want to do it. You know, I don't want to have boring fights. I don't want to have a grudge match where it's all hatred. I want to go in there and put on a show, and Matt's a real entertaining guy, and so I think I am too. So I think it should be a real, real entertaining fight for the fans.
Cool. It looks like on your record here on. Sure, Doug, I'm looking at it. You fought a lot of guys with UFC experience even before you got into the UFC. So it seems like you're definitely prepared to fight at this level. What's it been like so far being a part of
Part of the UFC?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't even know if it's hit me yet. You know, I've just been smiling ever since I got a phone call in January. It's like a whole new life. Before fighting in the UFC, you know, my whole goal of fighting was to become part of the UFC. So when I was fighting guys like Rich Clemente, especially after coming off the Goulet win and then having the win streak going, I was petrified. You know, fighting wasn't fun to me because I knew if I lost, I was never going to get my opportunity to be in the UFC at 36 years old. If I had to start all over again and make another, you know, coming off a loss and then try to make a 4 or 5 fight win streak, it was going to take me a long time. And I didn't know if I had that in me. So, you know, now I've accomplished my goal and I'm there. And now I just get to enjoy it. And, you know, there's no stress. It's just a matter of having fun and seeing where I end up now. I don't have to care about winning or losing. I just have to go in there and perform. So.
And what do you know about Matt as far as strategy and that sort of thing? Is there anything that you've picked up as far as weaknesses and stuff like that?
Well, you know, Matt likes to stand and bang, and he's known to put on exciting fights, but he's not used to standing and banging with someone to hit the target as I do, so I'm not expecting him to stand up and bang me for very long. As soon as he feels my power, I'm expecting him to try and take me down. His biggest strength, I think, is his conditioning and then his wrestling. I don't think he's like a spectacular wrestler, but you know, I think he might have a little bit of a longer experience level in wrestling than I do. But as far as submissions go, I think we're equal. And as far as striking goes, I think I'm far advanced than him. So, you know, I definitely think his weakness is his bravery, but you know, that after pain or you never know how it's going to work out. If I catch him the right way, he's going to sleep.
And how did you get into fighting in the first place?
MMA took me a long time to get into, but I've been doing martial arts for over 20 years. I started out, you know, as most kids did, watching Bruce Lee movies and Kung Fu cinema and stuff like that, and just ran around the house throwing kicks, and I've always loved it. I got into Taekwondo as a small kid. I grew up in a really small town, 2,600 people, so there was no such thing as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or anything around where I was at. So I did some Taekwondo and getting my black belt around 18 years old, 17, 18 years old. I started doing some boxing. And then I just kind of felt, you know, trained on my own for a long time because there's nowhere really to go. I was just always good at fighting. Even when I was in Taekwondo, like, I could walk in the door as a white belt and I could sit there and spar with the black belts.
I couldn't even do my pattern right to get my yellow belt, but I could fight. Boxing was the same way. Within like a month, I could sit there and spar with the pros and hold my own. From just naturally, I could do it. I really enjoyed doing it. And then an MMA gym opened up. A local guy started fighting MMA and had a small gym, and we just hooked up and started training together. And from then on, I ended up meeting Sean Tompkins and joined Team Tompkins about 8 years ago, and the rest of us carried Darren Sure Dog.
And is there anybody out there that you're a big fan of that you try to pick up stuff from and you watch anytime he fights?
I mean, as far as a fan of, you know, there's so many great athletes out there. And I pick up stuff from anything I see. It could be an amateur fight, a hockey fight, you know. You can pick up stuff anywhere. There's no wrong way to hit somebody, right? So any idea could possibly work if you know how to set it up and use it. But as far as like people I'm a fan of, you know, John Jones, spectacular athlete, does some crazy stuff I like. Anna Silva, you have to love him. And then as far as, like, the guy I'm the biggest fan of, I want my career to kind of go after, would be Chris Lytle. You know, a guy that just comes in there and leaves it all in there and puts on great shows and win or lose, just go on while watching play the game.
Yeah, we had Chris on the show a couple times over the years, and I'll never forget one time we asked him what he missed about the old days when he fought in Iowa, and he was talking about not being able to the headbutt anymore was what he missed most. You know, from to be able to headbutt guys when you're in the cage.
I never experienced any of those fights like that. I don't think I'd want to. I consider myself a pretty good looking guy for a fighter. I like to keep my nose where it's at.
Yeah, he had a great finishing fight too against Dan Hardy there. And
I pulled that guillotine out. I don't know what Hardy was thinking going for that takedown in there.
Yeah, that's a good guy to try to emulate. That is definitely well-rounded career and fought hard every fight. And got a lot of bonuses. I think he like set records for this amount of bonuses.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if Sam Stout might have beat him now. I'm not too sure if he still has it or not.
Chris, I have to ask you, Chris, coming from a taekwondo background, have you changed your kicking style much as far as MMA? Have you altered much?
It took me a long time when I first joined Team Tompkins to learn more of a Thai style kick. And to turn my hips over and dig my shin in as opposed to my foot. So when I'm training, I'm hitting the bag and I'm kicking pads, yeah, it trains my kick 100% of the time. You know, I'm digging in more like a Thai style, K-1 style kick, but when in the heat of the moment sometimes, that snap kick still comes out. And the thing is, I still use some of my Taekwondo kick. I still do the spinning back kick and, you know, reverse roundhouse kick. So I still use some of them sometimes. So I plan on using some of them on Saturday night as well.
Well, I think that we're seeing a little more of traditional martial arts come into the equation because everyone's become so good at the boxing and Muay Thai combination that sometimes you don't see a lot of traditional stuff, and consequently your opponent might not be expecting it because you fight the way you train, and if you don't train to defend against it, it could give you an advantage. So we'll look forward to seeing it a little bit.
Yeah, I'm a true believer in, you know, anything can work if you know how to set up properly.
Right.
If you know why and there's a reason. There's one more thing than how to punch. Like a lot of boxing coaches and striking coaches, they sit there with their students and they teach them, throw the cross like this, throw your punch like this. Well, it's one thing to know how to throw a punch, but you have to know why and when to throw it, right? And any move can work if you know why to throw it and when to throw it. So
mm-hmm.
You know, that's why the traditional stuff is coming out, you know, like, some guys are going back to the roots and they're trying things and they're being a little bit more adverse. And you can't teach an MMA fighter to box because it's not boxing. I don't even spar with a boxer. And boxers come into my gym and spar some of the other guys and ask me to spar. I'm like, no, this is stupid. Why am I going to spar a boxer that's going to stand in front of me and fight me in a position I'm never going to be into in an MMA fight without getting taken down or clinched or grabbed onto? So, you know, MMA is a totally different striking game and anything can work. As long as you're practical about it and you figure out how to use it the right way.
Good point.
Now, do you have a favorite strike, submission, or technique?
My favorite strike for sure is my spinning back kick. It's a very powerful kick, and the fans love seeing it. And it's, know, I dropped Keith Suzuki with it in my first round of my UFC fight as well. I can't believe it. He didn't come back. He came back from there.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. I lost you for a second.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. Oh, we lost Tony. That's what happened. Lost one of our co-hosts. Let's connect him back. I hope to work on that. Now, what do you love most about mixed martial arts?
All right, get Tony Holland back in.
Yeah, that's me calling him. We lost you there for a second, Tony.
I know. I was just texting you that my phone cracked out.
Oh, yeah. For once, it's a technical difficulty not on my end. But, Chris, what would you say you love most about mixed martial arts?
I think I like the range of it. It's not, like I said, it's not boxing. I'm not limited to one thing. And then I get to be free with what I can do, right? There's so many options of things you can do. And it's hard for a guy like to be stuck in one thing. We can only, you know, what do boxers do? They got an uppercut, a jab, and a cross, and a hook. You know, I got ADD. I can't be doing the same six punches over and over and over and over again for 20 years. You know, with MMA, it's never ending. You can always learn something new that could possibly work. There's so many different angles you can come at and so many different techniques you could use. And you can kind of create things on your own and almost be like, you know, you can change yourself as a fighter. You don't have to be the same person over and over. You can just keep advancing and learning different ways, and you can become a striker, and you can become a wrestler, and you can become a grappler. Or you can just do all three. Or, you know, it's just so many options is what I love about it.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the same old stuff in boxing, because we've had this discussion before about, you know, how boxing need to kind of think of something new. And actually, it's been done before where guys kind of change things around. They don't do the average Joe type of striking techniques with the most famous case probably being Muhammad Ali. Actually, his wife was doing karate at one point, and he was watching her, and he adopted a technique that not a lot of people know he used to use a lot, but he would actually club guys in the shoulder, like a downward punch, and, you know, it would tire out their arms after a while. He kept doing it. And sometimes it looked like a defensive thing, like he was just pushing them off, but he was actually trying to open his glove and, you know, karate chop that shoulder. And another guy, Canadian guy, drawing a blank right now, but his technique, they called it the smash. It was like an uppercut that would turn into a power jab. Who was it, Tony?
Razor Ruddock.
Razor Ruddock, yeah. Say that again, Tony.
The don't mess with the Rain Man of boxing, I know it all.
Yeah, we call Tony the Rain Man of boxing. Obscure facts, that's no. You know, you talked about cutting weight earlier, Chris. So what would you say is the most important thing that you do to get ready for a fight?
Cardio. Can't breathe, you can't fight. No matter how many techniques you know or how good you are at this, you can't breathe, you can't fight. It's simple as that. So nothing's more important than getting your cardio in. Like, you're going to miss a workout. If you can't hit pads that day or you can't wrestle that day, you got to make sure you still get your cardio workout in that day.
Yeah, Chris, are you trying to combine the short-term wind sprints, like the high-intensity cardio, with a little more long-distance stuff? Do you do them both, or do you have a preference for one or the other?
I do them both. Mainly I do the long distance running and stuff like that. Generally I do it in the mornings, and I do it only mainly for weight loss purposes, and, you know, just that longevity. But MMA is not a slow, long fight. It's an explosive fight, so you have to be doing sprints, and you got to get on, like, do intervals on the treadmill, and, you know, I do hills or do circuits at the gym. You know, you got to be able to push your heart rate up. So
yeah, and I really think that the best way to do it is to combine the two, because it seems like in the old days, everyone just would go out for long distances, and then maybe 5-10 years ago, it became the short-term sprints, and everyone forgot about the long-term stuff. But I really think you can find the balance between the two of them. I think they both complement each other.
Yeah, yeah, I think you have to do both.
Right.
Do you have any predictions for your upcoming fight here on Saturday?
Do I have what?
Any predictions?
I'm always going to predict a knockout when I fight. Every time I fight, my prediction is going to be I'm going to win by knockout, because I know if I hit anybody solid, pretty much they're going to sleep. Other than Keith Wisniewski, yeah, I think he's a zombie. Yeah, he just won't die.
Yeah.
But anybody I've ever hit solid pretty much goes down. So I'm predicting a knockout, and if I had my dream fight, it'd be a knockout in the third round after a great fight. I could try and win both bonuses.
All right. Yeah,
that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah, that's one of the things we're always talking about is fighter pay, and you know, we'd all love to live in a world where you don't need bonuses, but boy, they really help. I just wish,
especially the new guys like me. You're a new guy like me. You're not making that much money.
Right.
You know, just the hotel they got us in right now is the hotel's $200 a night almost, $189 a night. So if you bring in some corner money, you got to pay for the hotel for 4 nights. Just that alone is $800. So there's, you know, 10% of your show pay right there. Not
yeah.
to mention how much money you spend on your trainers.
That's something.
My wife's plane ticket.
I mean, if they're paying for your health care, they ought to be paying for that, too.
The thing is, health care doesn't really make much difference for Canadians because we have free health care anyway.
That's true.
I love the UFC is doing it. That's great that the UFC is doing it. You know, especially if it's an American fighter. Like, not mad at an American fighter. Having to make a win in a fight for the pay that I'm doing in this hotel room, and then having to pay, you know, $1,500 to go to the hospital after. You know, so it's a great thing that the UFC did by doing that.
All right, well, we just got our 90-second warning, so you want to give a shout-out to anybody or any final thoughts?
I want to give a shout-out to everybody. Check me out on Twitter, at Menace Clements, and I give thanks to all my training partners. All my training partners down at Dillon Training Center, Rowan Cunningham, Andrew Elliott, Sean Brooks, Sam Stout, Chris Hordesky, Mark Hominick, and my management company, Apex Sports. My management and sponsorships, Venom, Venom Affliction and Training Mask.
All right, well, it's been great talking to you, and I'd say good luck, but I don't think you need it. Get ready for this, and more power to you. Keep doing the good work in the cage, and let them know that you need a raise.
I'll get it soon enough.
All right, Chris, I know you're going to put on a good show. We'll be looking forward to it.
Thanks, guys. I'll talk to you again.
All right, folks, so we're going to sign off. And get the 10-second warning there. So adios, and until next week.
All right, let's enjoy the fight.
Thanks to our sponsors, drinkcocaine.com, Milifidel, MILIFIDEL.com. And see you later.